In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, Inauguration Day has come and gone, and so has Obama. In the greater scheme of things, Obama's time in office was very fleeting, and because so much of what he did was by executive order, so much of what he accomplished will also soon be gone. And though it's just starting, President Trump's time will also be fleeting. We are given such precious little time here on Earth, and before we know it, President Trump will be handing over the reins of power to his successor. Just think about that for a moment. It is such a rare event in all of mankind's history to turn over the reins of power, and not just peacefully, but to someone who has completely different views of power and of the direction of the country than you do. But it will be a short time, all things considered. The good thing is, President Trump is a man who doesn't waste time. He values it. He loves to work. He wants to get busy. He wants to start turning around what he sees is wrong with America today, where not everyone is prospering, where those who are prospering all too often have their foot in the halls of government. And God bless him for that. And may God bless America as we undo the mistakes of the past, not just the last 8 years, but decades of mismanagement that has made government strong and the people weak. And Inauguration Day is the first step toward that goal. On today's show, it's all about Inauguration Day. I know it's past by the time that this will air on Saturday and Sunday, and we know that others are also giving tiny tidbits of the history of the day, but we wanted to go a bit deeper than that. We'll take a deeper look at the history of some of the traditions of Inauguration Day and where they come from. To talk about the history and traditions of Inauguration Day, I'd like to welcome Greg Leo. Greg is a political and business consultant in his day job, but an avid historian as well. I guess you could say he's iSpy Radio's in-house historian. Greg, it's always fun to talk to you.
Great. Thank you for having me, Mark. Appreciate being on. Thank you.
Yeah, so there are some existing traditions within the Inauguration Day, and I think we'll just kind of walk our way through some of those. But, you know, this is just kind of a free-flowing conversation between us. And one of the big things that kicks the day off and has been since 1933 with FDR is the tradition of attending a morning worship service on Inauguration Day. You know, I have to say that when I first saw that, that came as a little bit of a surprise because I would have thought that tradition was much older than FDR.
Well, you'd think it would go back further, but you have to think about the context of history here. You know, when FDR came in, it was right at the beginning of the Depression. You know, the country was really hurting. People were unsure of what the future would bring. And so I think FDR looked for the kind of symbols to stabilize the country and to let people know that things were back to normal. Nothing like a church service to start people off on the right foot there.
That's very true. I did note in some of my research that Washington did attend a service at St. Paul's Cathedral, which is absolutely gorgeous, in New York City immediately after the inauguration. But it was kind of interesting that particular tradition of attending church on the day of the inauguration didn't really stick.
Well, you know, it's a separation of church and state is, of course, one of the premises in the Constitution. So it is a bit of a fine line, but we also are a country that believes in God, says in God we trust on our money, and it's important, I think, to have the support of the Creator when you're trying to manage a very big and difficult country.
Yes, very true. Although it is also interesting when you look at it, the day, whether it's March 4th or later January 20th, whenever that fell on a Sunday, they would actually hold over until the following Monday. So even so, they were still honoring God with the inauguration.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that is the social convention of the day, and that, you know, people were strong in their beliefs and did not think that that kind of business should go on during on a Sunday. And, you know, of course, we have it this year on a Friday, which really is a whole week of activities if you look at the schedule for this entire inauguration.
Yes, yes, very much so. They've got a concert the night before and all sorts of things going on beforehand. Following the morning worship, and they will a lot of presidents will have a luncheon of some sort or tea with the incoming president. I know that that's on the docket for this year. But then the next big tradition is the procession to the Capitol, and this is where the outgoing president and incoming president-elect will ride together to the Capitol for the new president to take the oath of the office. This dates back to 1837 when Andrew Jackson, the outgoing president, rode together with Martin Van Buren, the incoming one, to the Capitol. However, those rides haven't always been smooth and a little tense at times as well. I know that between Herbert Hoover and FDR, they didn't speak a single word to each other on March 4th, 1933.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the symbolism is very important because this is a peaceful transition of power. And you think about the way our country handles this, these traditions really are there to reinforce the idea that, you know, regardless of whether your party is won or not, that the country's business will go forward. And especially the FDR trip to the Capitol, I think, was significant because, like this inaugural, it's quite a bit of difference between the outgoing administration and the new administration. So the whole point of these traditions, I think, is to show that our republic is an ongoing concern and that, you know, we are a nation which will weather all of the trials and travails that come before us and will still continue to be America and have a system of government that everyone can be proud of.
Well, and not only a system of government, but also that it's bigger than two people, the incoming and the outgoing president, and even, I guess, if you throw in the third one there, in this case where we had Hillary that was competing to be president, our country is bigger than just these individuals.
And we have a major policy difference this time, as we did with Andrew Jackson and, again, with FDR, where, you know, it's kind of a sea change in the direction of the country, which is what makes this such an important inauguration, because we see that it is a very different approach to how the federal government should be run and what direction the country should be going. But, you know, to our credit, there are not armed guards in the streets. There will be protests, and that's part of the American way, too. We should talk about that in a minute. But the main thing is, the main message here is, as the greatest country in the world, we have a transition of power, you know, which honors, you know, all parties, and which does not make the vanquished turn away, but rather everybody forward.
Yes, and it is, generally speaking, a peaceful transition, but it's certainly not without its acrimony, as we'll talk about in the upcoming segment. Stay with us. Lots more with Greg Leo talking about Inauguration Day. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about Inauguration Day. And even though this is airing on Saturday and Sunday after the Inauguration Day, we're really featuring a historical look back at many of the inaugurations in the past and some of the traditions that make up this very important day. And we're talking with Greg Leo, who is a political and business consultant in his day job, but an avid historian by night, I guess. So, Greg, we were talking, kind of going out of the break there, about some of the acrimony and some of the bad feelings between incoming and outgoing administrations. And, of course, that's really making the news cycle this time around. You've got a group of Democrats that are refusing to attend the inauguration. This kind of thing is not actually unusual. In fact, there was a great article up on LifeSit that talked about the contest between Adams and Jefferson. And even within that, they were talking about how there was essentially fake news at the time, and between the two, and also the influence of the French in the election of Jefferson. And it's kind of funny how history tends to repeat itself.
You know, it really does, Mark. The controversies of the past are kind of spun forward here as we see it today. It is a large list of congressional you know, officials who are not going to be at the inaugural, three coming from Oregon, which I was interested to see that, you know, Kurt Schrader is not going to go, for example, and Peter DeFazio and Earl Blumenauer. But, you know, that's their right. Under the First Amendment, people have the right to, you know, have political free speech. And if one way of showing it is not going to inaugural, well, okay, that's kind of part of the system. However, all of us as Americans need to support the president. And, you know, in a sense, there is a way that Americans need to work with the administration, even if you don't agree with their political philosophy. So all of us have been in a time when there was a president that we didn't support, and how we voice our disagreement with the current administration is super important. But in this particular case, this is the way the congressmen have decided to exercise their free speech, and that's their right.
Well, I think in some sense they risk the chance of alienating themselves from the process as we go forward. There was a really fascinating article in the Washington Post that I just read this morning, and it was about these Never Trump people within the intelligence agencies, and they had signed this letter saying that Trump was unfit, and they were very acrimonious as well and at that time, I think he had gotten the nomination, but they had just decided they were going to come out against him for whatever reason. And now they're surprised that Trump just isn't tapping any of them for cabinet posts, or he's not even calling them for advice, and they're just so surprised by that.
And this is not unprecedented. We saw a similar situation with John Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, where the CIA was discredited. He let the CIA director and the National Security Advisor go after receiving what he felt was bad advice about Cuban policy. And this is the president's right. The president will come in. He can select people of outstanding merit and ability to serve in his administration. If he doesn't have confidence in them, he should not have them in those positions of high authority. And so, Trump has every right to pick the team he needs to move the country forward, people he has confidence in. And, frankly, some of the intelligence hasn't been very good.
No.
So it's something a new president needs to do. Everybody comes in with a broom. Generally, there's a clean sweep, and you put people in the office who have the ability to give advice and to help you in a way to manage a very important process.
That's right. And for the people that are sitting out the inauguration and these intelligence individuals that are so surprised they're not getting tapped for any kinds of posts, well, when you decide to sit on the sideline and boo the quarterback that's on the field, guess what? You may not come into the game. So let's talk a little bit more about the history of all of this. The vice president swearing-in ceremony, up until 1937, the VP was sworn in the Senate chambers, but that has changed over the years. And I also found it really interesting that unlike the president's oath of office, there is no oath specified in the Constitution for the VP. Any thoughts on why that is?
It's interesting. It isn't in the Constitution, but all of us who have taken the oath, and I've taken it, I think, three times, know the oath and essentially know it by heart, because it is so important that every federal official swear the oath and live the oath, really. I mean, that we protect our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And it's that oath that is so important. I was delighted to see the vice president being sworn in by Clarence Thomas. I think he's been a great Supreme Court justice, and it's really great to show that all Americans are supportive. And so I'm just very pleased to see that. And, I think the standard oath that all federal employees take should be the oath that the vice president takes. Of course, now the vice president is a political official. He's president of the Senate under our Constitution. And the fact he's doing it publicly rather than in the Senate, I think, sends a signal about this administration being of the people and not necessarily of the government or of the Senate. So I think the symbolism is strong there.
Yes. Yeah. I always thought it was interesting that the vice president actually took his oath before the president. I mean, I guess you would, just logically think that it would be the other way around. But that, too, stems from tradition where the outgoing vice president would gavel the outgoing Senate. But as part of that, he would then give a speech, his outgoing speech. But a lot of times they would actually run over. And so in order to fit the to meet the noon requirement for the next president and vice president to be gaveled in or to be sworn in, they actually had to rewind the clock in the Senate chambers.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And it does need to be done exactly by the Constitution at noon on January 20th. That's when the president needs to be sworn in. And the vice president's swearing in is really, as we know from our system of government, not as important. And so, you know, the fact, I think, is really driven by the big speech.
Yes.
The inauguration speech over time has been that setting the course for the administration. And there have been some magnificent speeches. We always think of Lincoln's second inaugural as the great healing speech from the Civil War, and John F. Kennedy's call to action, you know, for the country to, you know, put national interest ahead of personal interest. And so here's an opportunity for Donald Trump to use his excellent communication skills to try to get the word out about what the direction of this administration is. So I actually look forward to the speech. I think it's
yes.
The whole world will be watching to see the tone and the direction that the president will set in his inaugural speech.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about the inaugural speech coming up in the next segment, along with some traditions around the president swearing in as well. Stay with us. Lots more with Greg Leah. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpire Radio Show. We're talking today about Inauguration Day and a look back at some of the traditions and history of such a day. And we're talking with Greg Leo. He is our go-to guy for all things history. And so, Greg, we're talking about the vice president. And, of course, the whole point of Inauguration Day is the president's swearing-in ceremony. There have been 57 presidential inauguration ceremonies for 45 presidents held at over 10 different locations. The current location on the west side of the Capitol was actually started by Ronald Reagan in 1981, and up until then it had been on the east side. And do you have any idea why he moved it to the west side?
Yes, I think it was entirely symbolic. Ronald Reagan, of course, is a Westerner, and looking west from the Capitol, you have this magnificent expanse down the Capitol Mall, and it is just a absolute stunning location to do it. You can accommodate a lot more people than on the east portico. The east steps of the Capitol is a relatively confined area compared to the west yeah. steps. But I think the symbolism was about a forward, looking forward. And this is a person from the west who brought in new ideas to Washington and a new type of government to Washington, a government more connected to the people, a smaller government, more efficient. And Ronald Reagan had some messaging he wanted to do, and changing the location, I think, did it well.
Now, were you in attendance for that one?
I was not. I was appointed to my first Reagan position in March of that year. So I was not back there for the inaugural that time. I was there for the Reagan second inaugural and the Bush, 41 first inaugural. So I've been to two inaugurations.
I see. Well, weather has not always been kind to the president. On his inauguration day, the worst weather actually was for William Howard Taft. That was March 4th, 1909. They actually had to move it indoors inside the Senate chamber because the blizzard, strong winds were toppling trees and telephone poles. Trains were stalled and city streets were pretty unpassable. Perhaps a close second to that was on JFK's inauguration when they actually had to use Army flamethrowers to clear snow from Pennsylvania Avenue.
You know, the weather in Washington can be brutally cold. And I remember the first Bush inaugural when it was so cold that, you know, bottles were breaking outside if there was any liquid left in them. There were just really horrendous cold. And it is a difficult thing because the East Coast, of course, you do get terrible cold. But the worst story, I think, is William Henry Harrison, who caught cold giving his inauguration speech and died eventually from it. So
he also had the longest speech on record. He thought it was going to show his bravado because apparently he was out in freezing cold without a jacket on, and they think that led to him catching pneumonia. And you're right, he died a month later.
Yeah, and so it does have consequence. And of course, we always worry about, you know, the safety of people at these events. It does look like the weather is moderating in Washington. It'll be a little bit warmer. Because there should be a lot of people out in the streets, first for the inauguration and second to protest the inauguration. So Americans look like they may be coming out of their deep freeze. Of course, the weather's been terrible all the way across the country. And now it's warming up, and they'll probably get out and exercise their rights.
Well, Reagan actually had both the coldest and the warmest inauguration day. His first inauguration was the warmest on record, had a noontime temperature of 55. but his second inauguration was the coldest on record with a noon temperature of 7 degrees.
I remember that, and it was horribly cold. And I remember going to the balls and the events, and everybody was totally bundled up, and it really felt like you were in Moscow rather than Washington.
Wow. Wow. So
it was a great night. Also say it was a fun night. The Reagan inaugural, the balls were wonderful. There were, I think, 10 of them that year. And, of course, they're regional, and they were just great fun. The whole, it's kind of like a week of events because people come in from around the country, and you go to a number of different receptions and events. So people are making connections, and there's a lot of excitement about a new incoming administration and the possibilities that new administration can bring for the country.
Hmm. Well, the oath that the president takes is the only oath specifically spelled out in the Constitution. And it's interesting when you read like the final draft versus the one right before it. And let me just read you the oath that President Trump has taken by now. This is right out of the Constitution. Before he enters on the execution of his office, the president shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, the previous draft was a slight wording change that the president was to act to the best of his judgment and power instead of to the best of his ability. And it's kind of interesting when you look at how the minor wording change really made this more of a sacred oath to preserve, protect, and defend not the country, not his own ideology, not even the people, but the Constitution himself, and sought by swearing, that really meant that he was the president's duty to preserve, protect, and defend was really tying that to his obligations to God.
It is a great change. It's a change with great meaning. It shows a deeper commitment, I think. The Constitution, of course, is the most important aspect because that's what lives on beyond all of the different administrations and political ideologies or congresses. The Constitution is our living document. And so I think that's a very appropriate oath, and it was a good change.
Well, it's also interesting by making it to the best of his ability rather than his to the best of his judgment and power. Because if you were to use judgment and power instead, what that would really essentially say is it's open to interpretation, my interpretation as president, in terms of what exactly needs to be defended.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's judgment is everybody can question whether judgment was good or not. It opens it up to a debate. That the best of your ability, though, is a total commitment, not just of your judgment or your mental ability, but everything about you as a person. So I think it goes to the entire fiber of a person.
Yes.
That you commit to the best of your ability. So, and that is what you really want, I think, in a leader, is one that is absolutely committed to protecting and preserving the Constitution, because it's the Constitution that protects the rights for the rest of us.
That's right. Great point. Okay, everyone stay with us. We're going to continue with all of this discussion on Inauguration Day with Greg Leo coming up after this. And welcome back to iSpire Radio Show. Talking today to Greg Leo. He is an avid historian, but he's also a political and business consultant as well. And he is our go-to guy for all things history. And we're talking today about Inauguration Day, which all of you have seen by now. But we want to talk about some of the history behind all of that, especially some of the traditions as well. And Greg, one of the big traditions, of course, is the inaugural speech. And this is actually something that Washington inadvertently started. He was not required by the Constitution to give an inaugural speech, but he did anyway. And every president since has given an inaugural address since then. And the longest, as we mentioned before, was 8,445 words, would have taken somewhere in the area of 45 minutes, maybe an hour. And that was William Henry Harrison, to just 135. You know who that one was?
No, I would think Reagan, though.
No, 135 words. That was actually Washington's second inaugural address. Yeah, and it's of course you can find that online. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. But very businesslike inaugural address, basically said, thanks for this, and let's get to it.
You know, of course, he was continuing his administration. And I would say that the speech is so important to the incoming administration because there's a sense of newness with every administration that comes in. And you have to kind of understand the cycle of the federal government. I mean, at the end of a Congress, there's a mad rush. Then you have an election, in this case, a major election, major directional change for the country. And so the new president comes in with a clean slate. Mm-hmm. And people have a great sense of anticipation. Well, what does this mean for us? How is the country going to move? What direction? What are the prospects for the legislation that I'm concerned about or whatever? People have their own point of view. And so this is really the first time that the new president has to say, this is it. This is what our administration is about, the yes. direction we're going to take. Of course, you know, I think the most stirring one was John F. Kennedy's call to action in 1960, which really set a tone for his entire administration. It's a great opportunity for an orator to really put out a message that says, this is who we are and this is where we're going.
Yes. These were not always public events, interestingly enough. Washington actually started the swearing in as being outside. He went outside on what was then the Senate building and stood on the porch so that way the crowds could see him take the oath of office. But then he actually gave the inaugural address inside the Senate chambers, and it was that way for quite some time. That changed with Madison's second inauguration. They were going to have a ceremony in the House chamber of the temporary Capitol, but actually a small feud ensued between the Senate and the House of Representatives over what chairs would be used in the House chamber. And so they ended up having to push it outside to an outdoor platform in front of the building.
You know, over time, our government has become more open, more participatory, more accessible to people. You know, and really you see things like direct election of U.S. senators as opposed to legislators in states electing them. Things that have really engaged more of the people. So it's not just symbolic, but it's also very practical that you would have it outside the chamber where, you know, anybody could come up and see it. With this particular inauguration, there are no tickets. You can go to this inaugural, you can hear Donald Trump's speech and not have to have a ticket. And that speaks volumes about how important the people are to this government. And that's really the way I think the founding fathers intended it to be. So the more public, the better, and the more that people can access and hear directly is a good thing, I think, for our republic.
And I think that's very true. Of course, that does raise some security concerns as well, not needing any tickets. And that brings to mind, actually, some photographs that I have seen in the past. In fact, we're going to have a whole bunch of photos up on iSpyRadio.com. Including some recently rediscovered photos from Abraham Lincoln's first inauguration. And then there's also some recently discovered ones from Howard Taft's as well. But there was a fascinating photo from Lincoln's second address because within that photo, within probably I'd say about 30, maybe 50 feet from President Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth was standing there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a famous photo. And of course, Lincoln's security was, you know, famously bad.
Yes.
They think that, you know, there were two or three shots taken at him one time riding up to the old soldier's home, et cetera. And, you know, whereas Washington now is entirely fortified. I mean, last time I was in Washington, I couldn't believe how protected everything about the Capitol is. As late as the early 80s when I was working there, I would just, you know, go up and walk into the Senate gallery to listen to a debate. Nowadays, of course, you can't. You have to have a pass, and you have to really be cleared to go in the Capitol. So I think security will be well taken care of. There's a very strong security apparatus in place to protect the president. And so I do think it's a secure place. But that doesn't mean that some country or some interest group, some group out there might try to disrupt it in order to gain publicity. So that's why it's going to make for a very interesting watching as we see the public, event of the inaugural, and then we see the counter protests and the things that are planned for other people who disagree with the administration voicing their right of free speech. going to make for a very interesting TV watching on Friday, I think.
Yes, for sure. Let's go ahead and take a break a little early because coming up, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the presidential Bibles that have been used down through the years and some interesting choices there. Everyone stay with us. Lots more with Greg Leo. Talk about Inauguration Day. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, talking about Inauguration Day and some of the traditions and history of that, and doing that with Greg Leo. And Greg, you know, it's interesting that even though the president is required to swear an oath, there's no actual requirement that a Bible or any other specific book be used for the oath of office. In fact, there's been a wide range of things used. John Quincy Adams actually did not use a Bible at all. He chose to use a U.S. law book. Teddy Roosevelt in his first inauguration used none at all because it was shortly after an assassination and there was no Bibles present. Didn't even actually use anything other than raise his hand. When Kennedy was shot, there was no Bible present, so stewards found a Catholic missal belonging to the slain President Kennedy. And in case people aren't aware what that is, that's a liturgical book containing all the instructions and text necessary for Mass throughout the year. But, however, most of them have used one Bible or another, sometimes in fact two, which is what Trump is doing this year. He's using both his own personal Bible that his mother gave him when he completed a course in Sunday school, and then he's also using the famous Lincoln Bible, which is what Obama used as well.
Yeah, interesting. You know, constitutionally, we have a separation of church and state, so I can see why the Constitution doesn't prescribe a Bible. Of course, it allows you to affirm, which would suggest that you don't have faith and that you are just pledging. But the idea of swearing an oath is a very important personal matter and, of course, a religious matter. So the choice of the Bible, I think, is very important. You know, really asking for God's help to manage the country.
Yes.
And that's very important because, you know, in God we trust and, you know, it's just what a leader, I think, needs to lead a very complex, difficult country. So in any case, the choice, I think Trump's choice is actually pretty good. I would want to have Lincoln's Bible. I would also like to have Lincoln's wisdom, his ability to communicate. But I think that's a great choice because the country, under Lincoln's second term, of course, was at civil war. And he had the idea of how to bring the country back together that he had in his second inaugural speech. So yes. I think there's a connection there and some ripe symbolism. Having his own Bible, of course, is a, you know, it's a personal matter. And, you know, judging on how well the administration goes, maybe there will be people in the future that will want to swear on the Trump Bible.
Wouldn't that be an interesting thought? Huh?
Yeah. But well, I kind of see the thing there, you know.
Well, you know, the Lincoln Bible, even though it's referred to as Lincoln Bible, was not actually his. It turns out that when he was rushed into Washington under a cloak of secrecy and security, his luggage actually hadn't caught up with him yet. And so what they did was they used a Bible that one of the Supreme Court justices had on hand for such events, but it has been since known as the Lincoln Bible. George Washington actually started this as well, the Bible that he used, and that was then frequently used by other presidents later on, was a Masonic Bible. And as part of swearing, doing the swearing in, a lot of presidents will open the Bible to a certain verse, although George Washington apparently just opened it at random, and it landed on an obscure chapter in Genesis, Genesis 49, if I remember right, and it had something to do with where the tribe of Zebulun was going to be dwelling. So go figure.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and that is interesting, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this Bible will be received by people and all. I think it's going to be very well received, and this is an important part of the symbolism, asking for God's help to move America forward. And so I think the Lincoln Bible is a great choice.
I do, too. FDR actually used the oldest Bible, but it was not even written in English. It was written in Dutch. It was printed in 1686, but he used that one for all four of his presidential inaugurations. I know that Pence is actually going to use the Reagan Bible, which is an interesting choice.
Yeah. Well, and it shows his strong conservatism and his ties to the Reagan administration. Of course, I think that's a good thing, being a former appointee of the administration. And, you know, the symbolism is not lost on anybody that this is making America great again, much the way that the Reagan administration brought mourning to America. So I think, you know, Pence's choice is a good one as well.
Well, I think so as well. And of course, another tradition is the out with the old, so to speak, another big portion of the day is the parade. And this has actually changed. It used to be leading up to the Capitol, getting to the Capitol. That was the parade. It was a military procession that changed, I think, in 1841. When they started to include the public and floats and bands and some other things as well. And I guess with this particular parade, it's much smaller than we've had in the past.
The pageantry is pretty exciting, really. There'll be 8,000 participants, 40 organizations. We've got horse cavalry. We've got marching bands. We have people from all over the country. It looks like it's very geographically diverse. And in a way, it's kind of America on parade, and a great way to see all compass points of America represented. So, of course, it's a big event. It's, 3 p.m. Washington time to 5 p.m. So it's right before dusk on the 20th is when it will happen. That's following up the swearing in.
Yeah, and they've changed that. When that changed, it was apparently Grant doing the changing because he decided to do a military review from a stand in front of the White House. And so that's how it has changed from a procession to the Capitol. And the focus of the parade is actually after now the inauguration and the swearing in.
Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, Grant being the Civil War general and, the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the veterans of the Union Army of the Civil War, was the predominant political power in the country for Grant's election. So, essentially, Grant's catering to the base, and that's good. From his point of view, it was a strong coalition that ran America for many years. But I can see why he, as the general of the Union Army, would have the Army be in the parade, because it, of course, reinforces the whole history of the Civil War, which is, a big reason why Grant was elected.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Greg Leo talking about Inauguration Day. And welcome back to I Spy. We're into our final segment now with Greg Leo talking about Inauguration Day. And maybe to start wrapping things up, it is the out with the old with the presidential departure. And I think it was Ford that started the tradition that he left the White House in a helicopter. Any chance that they're going to send Obama out by firing him out of a cannon?
No, I don't think so. But it's a class thing for the outgoing president to quietly leave and not with a lot of fanfare, because the focus really needs to be on the new president and the country moving forward. And so I understand that the Obamas will be remain living in Washington, which is kind of unusual. Normally a president will go back to his home state. We've got one of the youngest ex-presidents ever, so I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot of Barack Obama in public life in the coming years, because he's a fairly young guy. So,
well, it really is interesting as you look at the history of the outgoing president. I mean, it really does speak to the fact that in America we have a very peaceful transition of power, even though it's acrimonious during the election and can get very terse and tense. And certainly with this election cycle, all of the fake news about Trump before and after the election.
Right.
But the president himself leaves in a very quiet ceremony. There's no big fanfare. There's no band that playing. It's just, generally speaking, it's some close members of his cabinet and maybe some of the other officials. I know that when Bush left the White House, I think even Nancy Pelosi was there, although it's rumored that she said, "Thank God he's gone." I think it's very interesting, though, that when here you have a president that was the leader of the free world, the leader of the most powerful nation on earth, and yet he leaves with kind of a whisper.
It is amazing, and it is very important. It's to the credit of our republic that this happens this way, that there is a not a clinging to power, but rather releasing that power and moving forward, moving on. And I think that is one of the great things about our country. And, it's really about the new president and about the direction of the country. So, and this is as it should be.
Yes. And so one of the other big traditions on Inauguration Day are the inaugural balls. There have been a wide range of the number of balls. I know that the lowest number was zero. That was Woodrow Wilson who decided that he wanted to save money and also didn't think that they were appropriate. I think there was another president that felt that way as well. But I know that in 2009, Obama had 10, but in 2013, he only had two. And then I think Trump is having just three this year.
The balls are a lot of fun. They're black tie affairs. They're generally, when there's many of them, they're generally broken out regionally, which it's a great opportunity to connect with people, and to see people is celebratory. And it adds to kind of the festive aspect of attending the inaugural. So a lot of people are, coming from long distances, a lot of times with adverse weather. You want to make it fun. They've had to suffer through a cold day at the parade. And this is something which really makes it kind of a fun event.
Now, you said that you attended Reagan's second inaugural. Did you manage to get into any of those balls?
I did. I went to two of the inaugural balls, and I enjoyed both of them. They were both difficult to get to. One of them was entirely icy. So it was a transportation issue to get there. But once you're there, they're generally in bigger venues in Washington. And as I say, they're regionally organized. So you saw a lot of people from – I saw a lot of people from the West and people that I knew through the campaigns. And it was really an exciting, fun event and well worth going to, I thought.
Well, I know that one of the reasons why Trump decided to have three balls rather than there were some initial discussions to have, five or 10 or a whole bunch of them was because he really wanted to focus on getting back to work and getting the country back to work.
Well, it sets a tone, and this is why Woodrow Wilson, who frankly was kind of a curmudgeon, he kind of takes the joy out of it in a way. But you need to have an opportunity for the country to celebrate because it's part of the healing process after the campaigns. And I just wanted to say, this is not the roughest campaign America's been through.
It feels like it does,
but I mean, compared to Adams and Jefferson, this one, it was a tough campaign, but not the toughest.
Or Jackson and John Quincy Adams. John Quincy, the outgoing president, didn't even go to the inauguration because there was so much acrimony between Jackson and he. Jackson had accused Adams of essentially his wife's untimely death because of all of the stress that was on her.
We have to, victors and vanquished have to put aside these differences and go forward as Americans. And that's the whole point of this. And if it takes a ball to have people, get to know each other better and not be angry, then that's what we need.
And getting America back to work, I think that's the whole focus here. So, Greg, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. I'd like to close with a few lines from President Trump's speech. Finally, we must think big and dream even bigger. In America, we understand that a nation is only living as long as it is striving. We will no longer accept politicians who are all talk and no actions, constantly complaining but never doing anything about it. The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action. Do not allow anyone to tell you that it cannot be done. No challenge can match the heart and fight and spirit of America. We will not fail. Our country will thrive and prosper again. Like I said at the beginning, President Trump is a man who doesn't waste time. He loves to work. Except unlike the recent past, when President Trump gets to work, it's for the good of the country. What will that mean? Only time will tell. But may God guide him and bless him in his work, and may God bless these United States because of him. Check iSpyRadio.com for some fun links to the history of Inauguration Day, some historic photos, and lots more. And share those with your friends on Facebook or Twitter, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.